leading Israeli-American genocide and Holocaust scholar, teaches at Brown University. And I asked him, why is this important? And he said, it's important because the nature of this group, this association, is a relatively conservative group. There's another more leftist, progressive, dynamic association, but these guys are pretty low key. They're careful about what they do. And the fact that they came out with such a big majority, I think 85% of them voted that Israel is carrying out a genocide, that's significant because it makes it pretty obvious to the whole world, if anybody needed more proof, that even conservative scholars, independent, serious students of this gruesome process of genocide and Holocaust and mass atrocities, they are coming right out and saying this is a genocide. The big question is what will happen next.
We have 10 seconds.
Will any of the major Western powers take action? Will the signatories of the Genocide Convention do what they're supposed to do, which is stop the genocide by any means possible?
Rami Khoury, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-American journalist, public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tadasena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Urban League of Portland, celebrating its 80th anniversary as a local civil rights organization. Urban League PDX provides housing, education, healthcare, and career services to local communities. Membership information at ulpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon House lawmakers pass an amended version of the state transportation funding bill. Activists caravan to the Northwest ICE Detention Center in Tacoma to show support for working migrants. And in national news, Congress is back in session, tasked with averting a government shutdown by the end of the month. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 2nd of 2025. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Hannah Francis. Oregon State House lawmakers passed a long-awaited transportation funding package Monday, which now heads to the Senate for approval. The bill would raise $4.5 billion over the next 10 years. Governor Tina Kotek called legislators back into session last week to pass the transportation package, after failing to do so in the regular session in the spring. A new amendment changes the payroll tax increase of 0.1% to help fund transportation projects to now sunset after only 2 years. The revenue would be split between local governments and the Oregon Department of Transportation, or ODOT. ODOT is poised to lay off nearly 500 workers later this month if the bill doesn't pass. Local transit agencies like TriMet are also facing dire financial straits, planning big service cuts this fall to make ends meet. Some lawmakers have criticized the bill because of a mistrust of ODOT and how the department spends its money. Climate organizations and transportation reformers say the bill doesn't invest enough in needed bike and pedestrian infrastructure and safety programs. The transportation funding bill passed the House on a narrow margin, with one Democrat, Anessa Hartman from Gladstone, voting no, and one Republican, Cyrus Javadi from Tillamook, voting yes. Javadi told Oregon Live, quote, "The cost of doing nothing is far greater than the cost of doing something if we fail to act. I've received a lot of phone calls from people I've never met in my life, asking me to vote no and threatening me I will lose my job if I dare vote yes. And to them I say, I think my job is worth a handful of jobs it's going to save up in Astoria if it comes down to that," end quote. The Oregon Senate will consider the amended transportation funding bill on Wednesday. In honor of Labor Day, a coalition of labor and immigrant rights advocates in Oregon and Washington organized a caravan to rally to the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. The caravan started in Southern California and left from Portland Monday morning. Jessica Rojas with the International Migrants Alliance says it's important this Labor Day to show support for working migrants who are being threatened with deportation by the Trump administration.
In our experience, those detained are primarily migrant workers who oftentimes are the ones that are putting the food on our tables, that are helping us with our groceries, that are taking care of our loved ones in hospitals.
The caravan is part of over 1,000 events that happened across the country on Labor Day to reject what organizers say is a billionaire takeover of government. Tyler Fellini is with Portland Jobs with Justice, another group that supported the caravan. He's speaking out about farm workers, calling them an exploited labor force and noting they're not allowed federal union recognition and the protections that come with it. He adds immigrant labor activists and workers speaking up for their rights have been targeted for deportation.
So labor has an obligation to show up and speak out against that. And this is just another example of showing that support, making sure that folks locked up inside the detention center can hear all of us on the outside.
Rojas says another group leading the caravan effort, Tengo Migrante, has been pushing for the release of detained Filipinos and has successfully freed two high-profile labor union leaders. Thousands of Oregonians rallied across the state on Monday in Workers Over Billionaires protests, organized in part by the group 5051. In Portland, protesters marched 2 miles through downtown condemning President Trump's strong-arm tactics and calling for him to be removed from office. Speakers at Waterfront Park called on protesters to fight for immigrant rights. There were over 30 demonstrations planned in Oregon, hundreds gathered in Medford, Salem, and Grants Pass, expressing solidarity with union workers. Labor Day demonstrations followed a weekend of protest activity across Oregon. A Sunday rally in Eugene protested the Trump administration and the deployment of the National Guard in D.C. In Astoria and Seaside, protesters held a Blanket the Beach weekend of demonstrations across Tillamook County. Senators and House members are back for the next congressional session after a 6-week break. They've got a lot of issues to resolve. The most urgent task for Congress is to avoid a government shutdown on September 30th. That's when federal funding runs out. It's unclear just how Republicans and Democrats will be able to agree on a plan satisfactory to all. It is nearly impossible for Republicans, who have razor-thin majorities in both chambers, to pass 12 planned appropriations bills through committee and the floor. Congress will have to pass a short-term spending measure to keep the government funded for a few weeks or months while they try to finish the full-year package. However, Republicans would need Democratic votes to pass an extension, and Democrats want significant concessions. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer voted with Republicans to avoid a shutdown in March, prompting significant backlash within his party. Many remain angry that Republicans rescinded about $9 billion in foreign aid and public broadcasting. Democrats also want to undo the Republican cuts to Medicaid and rural hospital funding. Schumer and Representative Hakeem Jeffries have demanded talks with Trump and GOP leadership. So far, that request has not been granted. Prior to the break, Democrats also delayed confirmation for Trump administration nominees, leaving many positions unfilled. Republicans now want to try and change Senate rules to get around the Democratic delays. Finally, two lawmakers want to force a floor vote on a measure compelling the release of the Epstein files. Speaker Mike Johnson opposes this, saying the Department of Justice should take the lead on this matter. Aging Democrats may imperil a possible House majority next year. South Carolina requests the Supreme Court uphold its transgender bathroom ban in schools, and the redistricting arms race is likely to reduce the power of people of color. With these stories and more, it's Simone Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy and historic times.
This is going to continue to be an issue where both parties might be putting their majorities into jeopardy if they are relying so much on these much older members of Congress who may have significant health issues.
Boise State political scientist Charlie Hunt says a reliance on older politicians is likely to make it harder to build stable, productive majorities in the closely divided Congress. It's an issue for both parties, but the last eight members who have died in office were Democrats. In New York City, several progressive newcomers have unseated older rivals. Longtime Representative Jerry Nadler will be 79 years old on Election Day, but faces 26-year-old political organizer Liam Elkind in the primary. Oysterman and 40-year-old Marine Corps veteran Graham Platner has launched a Democratic Senate bid in Maine, even as Minority Leader Chuck Schumer works to convince 77-year-old Governor Janet Mills to run. President Donald Trump's administration is pushing further to erode Congress's power of the purse. The White House Budget Office says Trump used a, quote, pocket rescission to cancel nearly $5 billion in foreign aid, challenging court rulings saying once Congress appropriates funds, the executive branch must spend them as allocated. The question is likely to become an important court fight. Legal experts say the current redistricting arms race that started in Texas could well dilute the votes of blacks and Latinos, typically by fragmenting urban districts and attaching fragments of them to conservative rural areas. Republican lawmakers in Missouri and Indiana say they're considering cracking Kansas City and Indianapolis-based districts in two. Sarah Rohani with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund says that resembles how voters of color have been excluded in the past.
In 2025, it's clear that our fight for fair maps continues, and to ensure that every single vote counts and to ensure that voters of color have equal opportunity and representation in this country.
The new district maps in Texas are being challenged in court on the grounds that they violate the Voting Rights Act protections for minority voters. That law is turning 60 this month, but the Supreme Court's Shelby County decision stripped federal oversight of voting in states that historically disenfranchised black voters. Georgia Democratic Congresswoman Nakima Williams says without the proposed John Lewis Voting Rights Act, too many people will have trouble exercising their access to the ballot.
It depends on your zip code. It depends on your bank account. It depends on who you are, what your access to the ballot should be, and that should not be the case.
Creating an open Senate seat in a state that previously leaned Republican, Iowa GOP Senator Joni Ernst says she won't seek re-election. Ernst had replied to a town hall comment that people will die due to Medicaid cuts by saying, quote, everyone dies. Democrats on House Homeland Security are demanding an investigation into Homeland Security's decision not to retain some potentially controversial text messages. The agency denied access to public immigration enforcement records to a nonprofit organization. South Carolina is asking the Supreme Court to lift a lower court injunction on its policy of forcing transgender people to use the bathroom of their gender at birth in public schools. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Wildfires are becoming more common, and the threat of a large earthquake is always looming in the Northwest. Experts say Washington seniors should take steps now to be prepared for the worst. AARP Washington is hosting a two-part online workshop to help older adults and the families who care for them stay safe and prepared for any disaster. Isobel Charlet has more on the story.
Less than a third of seniors have created a comprehensive emergency plan for natural disasters, and an upcoming workshop series from AARP Washington aims to change that. Helen Wiley is with SBP, a national disaster preparedness nonprofit that will be featured in the workshops. She says while people often think about how to brace for a natural disaster, making a plan to recover afterward is also part of being prepared. She adds recovery can bring many unexpected costs and recommends saving up if possible.
If you were displaced from your home for weeks or months, do you have that money to be able to live somewhere else for an extended period if you don't have friends or family nearby that you could stay with?
The Disaster Preparedness for Older Adults workshops will happen online on September 10th and September 17th. The sessions will cover how to create a recovery plan and how to stay safe during disasters. Registration information is available at aarp.org/Washington. Wiley adds insurance is one of the best tools for disaster recovery. She says having all of your paperwork in order will help you process claims and apply for aid post-disaster more quickly.
Putting your financial, legal, medical documents all in one place, making sure they're secure either in a waterproof folder, fireproof box, or having digital copies of them.
People, especially older adults, can be traumatized from disasters, says Wiley. She suggests family members and caretakers practice emergency plans to help everyone feel more comfortable.
Get your bags in the car, drive to where you would go. That kind of thing could really help someone feel less overwhelmed in that actual scenario if they were going to also be by themselves in it.
There is a lot to think about when it comes to emergency preparedness, so Wiley advises that people break things up into bite-sized steps throughout the year. She says any small thing people can do to prepare for the worst makes a difference. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. On this episode, host Michael Gaskill talks to author Adam Sawyer about grieving in nature and addiction recovery in nature. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with an overnight low of 59. Tomorrow will be overcast and warm, with a high of 86. Today in history, in 2023, the Indian Space Research Organization successfully launches their first solar observation mission. The quote of the day is from French poet and critic Paul Bourget. Born this day in 1852. He said, quote, "There are some, surely, whom you like and whom you dislike, for whom you entertain esteem and for whom you feel contempt. Have you not thought that you have some duties towards them, that you can aid them in leading better lives?" A study in Alaska is examining how microplastics move through the state's water system, and the research is getting a funding boost from NASA. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Studies show microplastics can be found throughout our ecosystem, and plastic pollution disproportionately impacts Indigenous communities. So scientists at Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage are studying how these tiny particles of plastic move through Alaska water. And they're developing the first in-state lab accredited to test water samples for microplastics. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports.
Nike McCampbell pulls on her diving dry suit and walks to the edge of the water at Smitty's Cove in Whittier. She dives below the surface. McCampbell will travel underwater about 80 yards from shore to collect water samples. She says they're studying how microplastics are transported through ocean currents.
And we're going to see where microplastics are moving.
She's part of a new team at Alaska Pacific University. Last year, the APU team got a $5 million grant from NASA to study microplastics in Alaska. Microplastics have already been found in the most remote corners of the state, So APU's research aims to expand that understanding by looking at how microplastics enter all water sources, including oceans and rain. Kian Muldoon is a graduate student on the research team. He says the ultimate goal of their work is to help reduce the harmful health effects of microplastics.
Hopefully using that research to inform cleanup efforts or to try to mitigate harm.
Back at the APU lab, Muldoon and his colleagues can use new specialized equipment to help identify various microplastics in the samples. The team has already collected samples from the summit of Denali, the Aklutna Lake watershed, and Prince William Sound. That's according to Dr. Dee Barker, a chemist and head of the research team. She says with new instruments funded by the grant, the team can identify particles small enough to likely pass through human tissues, and they can study the chemistry behind the microplastics they find.
The chemistry of that particle, how does that interact with the chemistry of a human being?
She says that understanding is missing from much of existing microplastics research. Ultimately, Barker says, they aim to get their lab accredited for microplastics testing. That would allow Alaska communities to send in water samples to test for microplastics. Barker says testing water sources is the first step in understanding how communities could protect themselves from the tiny plastic particles. In Whittier, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Native Americans are more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease or other dementias than white or Asian Americans. And because tribal members are already at risk of being murdered or going missing, it means having culturally sensitive resources when elders stray from home, as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
Megan Dickin is from the United Houma Nation in Louisiana and with the nonprofit International Association for Indigenous Aging. She recently presented a new toolkit which aims to help when Native elders wander.
It's very customizable, and so every community can utilize it in a way that suits them, and we encourage that.
Dickin says tribal police departments are often the first responders.
But a lot of times law enforcement is stretched thin. They don't have enough officers, or they don't have enough resources, or they have other crimes happening. So it can aid in community policing.
Her group says 80% of people with dementia will wander from home multiple times, while 90% may die if they are not found within 24 hours.
When they pass on, a lot of times that knowledge disappears. And we certainly don't want that to die with them prematurely because they went wandering and were not found in time.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Extreme heat can be deadly for workers and people without adequate air conditioning, but it can impact student athletes too. Parents created the Jordan McNair Foundation to teach coaches, trainers, and athletes to recognize the symptoms of heat exhaustion and act quickly. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2018, a hot, humid preseason football practice at the University of Maryland resulted in tragedy. 19-year-old offensive lineman Jordan McNair collapsed and later died as a result of heat stroke.
This was the loss of our only son, and I could have went into a rabbit hole of depression and despair.
But instead, Jordan's father, Marty McNair, decided to turn his grief into action. Shortly after Jordan died, McNair and his wife, Tanya Wilson, founded the Jordan McNair Foundation to help protect student-athletes from heat-related illnesses and death. It's a threat that's growing ever more urgent as the climate warms. They educate coaches and trainers to recognize the symptoms of heat exhaustion and to act quickly to cool the person down. They teach student athletes about the importance of advocating for themselves and speaking up when they do not feel well, before it becomes an emergency.
Hey, you got to listen to your body. If your body's telling you to stop, stop. You know, be willing and be, you know, brave enough to really speak up about that.
And they teach parents to reinforce these lessons at home.
And I think that's really where you start at in regards to protecting your child or teaching your child to protect themselves.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
A new report on school bullying surveyed 200,000 students. It finds that positive role modeling by staff can be very effective in combating that problem. Suzanne Potter has the details on the study in California.
A report out today finds that school culture can go a long way to reduce bullying. Researchers from the nonprofit Youth Truth surveyed 200,000 students, K-12, and found that victims of bullying are more likely to turn to adults at home rather than at school, and less than half of U.S. students in grades 3-12 feel a sense of belonging at school. So, David McKinney with Youth Truth says schools need to intentionally foster a civil, friendly, open atmosphere.
When students see adults modeling respect, rates of bullying drop. They are less likely to say that they have been bullied or that they have witnessed bullying when they see adults treating other adults and treating kids with respect.
The study also found that Black and non-binary students often lack positive role models on campus. The data also shows that about 70% of bullying focuses on a student's appearance, and to a much lesser extent, their race, gender expression, sexuality, and disability. Schools with more diverse staff members who are trained to foster connection with students tend to have fewer problems with bullying. Kelly Jacob is director of High Tech Middle North County, a public charter middle school in San Marcos near San Diego. She says teachers spend the first week of school working to help kids feel like they're in a safe space with friends and trusted adults.
You know, lots of schools, it's like day one, here's the syllabus, we're going to get to the math and science. That's super important. But before anything, you've got to help kids understand that they are valued and loved and respected and that they're in a school and a place that they want to be.
To make sure no one falls through the cracks, students at High Tech Middle attend a short advisory class first period all 3 years at that school. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
As President Trump campaigns for a Nobel Peace Prize, one observer says it's based on weak claims of peacemaking in seven conflicts. And none of those is the Russia-Ukraine or Israel-Hamas wars, in which Trump has failed to bring about ceasefires and has abetted continued warfare. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Four U.S. presidents have been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize: Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Jimmy Carter, and Barack Obama. Donald Trump is determined to be the fifth. He has been campaigning for a Nobel the same way he sells his merchandise, with a great deal of advertising, some pressure tactics, and plenty of false claims. It's hard to imagine that a man who is a convicted felon, an admirer and imitator of dictators, and an enemy of humanitarian aid and international institutions, including the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, could be a candidate for the award. Yet he is, and the leaders of Israel, Pakistan, Cambodia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia have put him up for it. Let's for the moment take Trump's candidacy seriously. His case rests on seven conflicts he claims to have resolved just months into his second term. Here's a brief review of those conflicts and Trump's role in them. First, Congo-Rwanda. The U.S. did help bring this conflict officially to an end when the foreign minister signed an agreement in Washington in June. However, a key player in the conflict, the M23 rebel group backed by neighboring Rwanda, was not part of the agreement. M23 claims that participants in the 1994 Rwanda genocide fled to Congo and are working with the Congolese army. Efforts to bring M23 and Congo into negotiations have thus far failed. Second, Egypt-Ethiopia. This conflict, which has gone on for over a decade, concerns the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam on the Nile. Power generation has caused friction between Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan. Egypt, whose farming depends on the Nile, and Sudan, which fears flooding, oppose the dam. In July, Ethiopia declared the project complete and set September for it to open. Trump's claim that the dispute, it's not a war, is over thanks to his intervention is simply incorrect. Third, India-Pakistan. The long-standing conflict centered in Kashmir never reached the stage of a war. Pakistan supports Trump's claim that he helped broker a ceasefire in return for tariff concessions, while India disputes Trump's role altogether and bristles at Trump's tariff hikes. Prime Minister Narendra Modi refuses to talk Nobel with Trump, and their one-time bromance has soured. Fourth, Kosovo-Serbia. Although tensions persist between Kosovo, which declared independence from Serbia in 2008, there is no war. But the two countries do not have diplomatic relations. Peacemaking is now largely in the hands of the European Union. Next, Armenia-Azerbaijan. Both countries' foreign ministers went to the White House to initial a peace agreement, and they hailed Trump's role. But a formal treaty to end their long-running conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh remains to be signed and ratified. Trump's real role was to secure a corridor in southern Armenia that links it with Azerbaijan and Turkey. The U.S. has been granted exclusive development rights in the corridor for 99 years. The corridor is named, get ready, the Trump Route for International Peace and Prosperity. Next, Cambodia-Thailand. U.S.-backed talks resulted in a ceasefire, not necessarily an end to their border conflict. Trump exerted trade pressure on both countries. Malaysia and China are also credited with helping secure the ceasefire. Next, Israel-Iran. Trump's claim comes down to dropping bunker-busting bombs to prevent a nuclear war. The evidence does not support the view that Iran was on the verge of producing a nuclear weapon. The U.S. launched attacks on Iran's nuclear sites in support of Israeli policy, which has long wanted a green light from Washington to eliminate Iran's nuclear capability. Bombing to obliterate, remember Trump's word, obliterate Iran's military potential amounts to war-making, not a peace initiative. The current ceasefire is most likely merely a respite as both sides recover. So on the evidence, Trump has a very weak case for a peace award. In only one conflict, Armenia-Azerbaijan, can he be said to have played a central role, and even then for personal gain as much as for peace. In all the other conflicts, fighting and disputing only halted temporarily. But the most glaring contradictions to Trump's claim are the Russia, Ukraine, and Israel-Hamas wars. In both, Trump has touted his peacemaking role, but has failed to use U.S. influence to force the central war-making leaders, Putin and Netanyahu, to accept a ceasefire and join peace talks. At every turn in those conflicts, Trump has ignored the human and economic costs of aggressive war, refused to sanction Russia and Israel for their barbaric behavior, accepted their claims to illegally occupied land, and curried favor with their authoritarian leaders. My conclusion? Only in a world turned upside down could Donald Trump be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, or for that matter, any prize that recognizes human decency and peace building. I'm Mel Gertal for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-